Alan Karpik with Tom Dienhart. Can't have a better colleagues. Can't have better colleagues than Tom Dienhart and Brian Newbert. The luckiest man on earth, lucky. I think. But it's our Saturday conversation, and we have there's no but involved, actually, but we're glad to be talking. Today's subject is coaches. We're going to reminisce through Jack Mullenkopf through Leon Burnett, and kind of just our musings and reminiscence of those guys. I'm a little bit older than Tom, so I have some firsthand. I've actually met Jack Mullenkopf and was in his presence a few times, and certainly have talked to a lot of players that had comments about him. But it'll be fun to reminisce. And next week we'll go in through from Fred Akers to Jeff Brohm, and then we'll begin that process with we'll go on our top assistant coaches, offensive assistant coaches, top defensive assistant coaches. So that's what the programming will be over the next 4 weeks or so. We want to thank our sponsors, and that's the Purdue Union Club Hotel. And I've been in that magnificent facility that they redo, a $35 million project. Even through this pandemic, done a marvelous job, beautiful 811 restaurant, refurbished rooms. The boiler up bar in the back, Tom, if you wanted to have a nice cold Coca-Cola and sit on the back, it's a nice atrium, not atrium, but kind of a patio area there between what would be the west side of the lobby there. And they've got a fire pit, really good place to be. And during the pandemic, probably a good place that you can socially distance, be outside. And I know they've had some folks there. So, again, we appreciate them as sponsors. And Tom, we're going to start with Jack Mullenkopf. And I'm going to start because I actually was in the second grade when I first met Jack. My dad used to go to practices. And back in the days, there were guys, that did. And coaches let certain guys in. And for some reason, my dad was never shy to ask his way into things, but he did. And I can remember meeting Jack Mullenkopf a couple of times, pretty intimidated by him as a second or third grader. I remember a Purdue game in 1967. Purdue plays Oregon State. Purdue's ranked third in the country or second, I can't remember, but unbelievably good. Oregon State actually was very good that year with Steve Priest, and their head coach was D. Andros, who was called the Great Pumpkin because he was a round dude. And he brought his team into Ross-Ade Stadium, and I remember it was the week of the game, and I this is maybe urban legend in the Karpik family, I don't know, but I think I said something to Jack Mullenkopf, who was portly but not completely round. I said, "Are you the Great Pumpkin?" That was his first grade. And I think I don't think I got to go to practice after that for a while, but Mullenkopf,
you're running laps.
Mullenkopf gave me a gracious response. Oregon State upsets Purdue on homecoming 1967. This is a Purdue team that shared the Big Ten championship and was ranked in the top five, maybe the best Purdue team of all time. And Oregon State beats Purdue. Purdue fumbles and several fumbles in that game, a 22-14 loss. But my memories of Jack Mullenkopf, one thing interesting about the guys you talk to, and I've talked to a lot of those guys from the Bob Greasys and the Mike Phipps and the Jim Bonks and the Leroy Keys of that era. They all had tremendous respect for Jack. I think Jack was a coach's, an administrative type coach. He had a very good staff, a lot of guys that did very well. We'll hit the assistant coaches later, but Jack was, and Jack didn't, suffer any fools. He got after things. He was a volatile guy. He could yell now and then, I'm sure. I know he watched the practice from the scaffolding at the top a lot, which a lot of coaches did. But the players that played from that are still alive certainly talk about the great respect that they had for Jack Mullenkopf. And he was a defensive coach. Came to Purdue as a line coach, took the, we talked before about him getting the job in 56 over Hank Stram. But Jack, was a Bowling Green grad. Is that right? 1931. And, came to Purdue, from that Northwest Ohio pedigree and, brought toughness to Purdue. They hung Jack at Mullenkopf and effigy a couple times at Kerry Quad because Purdue came close to getting the Rose Bowl. Fans wanted him out, if you can imagine that. And the year before, in 65, that might have happened when Purdue was actually ranked number one, lost a couple games. Fans fans were fans. They just didn't have the internet back then. And then Jack, of course, leads Purdue to a second place finish, but gets to the Rose Bowl because the Nova Bowl wins the Rose Bowl. And, you know, puts Purdue, yes, in 67 through 69, Purdue was 8-2, didn't quite, you know, they were ranked number one heading into the 68 season or in the top two. You know, they had, you can call those slight disappointments, but very competitive program. And the only school, I think still, maybe Alabama is that, but the only school to have four consecutive podium finishes for the Heisman Trophy from 66 to 69. Jack Mollenkopf recruited or and made talent out of the Mike Phipps, the Bob Creasys, the Leroy Keys of the world. So you were a little bit younger, but you've heard people talk about Jack. What's your view from that standpoint?
Yeah, a mythical figure for me, Alan, sort of in my mind's eye, so to speak. You know, Jack died. I'm looking at his some information. He died in December of 1975.
Right.
72 years old. So, I was too young to really remember him ever coaching Alan. But, again, my father would talk about Jack Mollenkopf. Of course, he and my mother both attended Purdue. And, yeah, Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
That was always a nickname I heard and would page through the media guides. And, you know, you let your mind wander and try to imagine what it was like to play for a guy like Jack Mollenkopf, almost a mythical figure in Purdue football. And I guess I would be fascinated from your perspective, Alan, if you were to pick the greatest coach at Purdue, did Joe Tiller pass what Mollenkopf did? Does Mollenkopf still sit on the throne of best Purdue football coach ever? I know maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but and Jack Mollenkopf really put Purdue on the map during that tenure and had the program playing at a level, you know, they never played at before.
Yeah, in the modern era, I don't know. I don't know. And I loved everything Joe Tiller did. And he brought the program back. Now, when Mollenkopf took the head coaching job, his only losing season was in his first year. And Purdue was not great in the early 50s. Yes and no. They did win a share of the Big Ten championship in 52. Lynn Dawson was there from 54 to 56. But Mollenkopf, Purdue played at its highest level of a program in the modern era, certainly. Modern era, post-World War II era, under Jack Mollenkopf. They were recruiting at the highest levels. They were ranked in the top 10. Relatively consistently. And he even had some really good teams in 60, 61, 62, teams that were very on the cusp. They'd lose a game to Illinois or lose a game to Minnesota was great at that time with Sandy Stevens, excellent program. But I think you have to give the nod to Jack Mollenkopf only because this was a program. Football was different then. Ohio State and Michigan during a key time for Mollenkopf was down just a little bit, you know, 66, 67, you know, Purdue beat Ohio State 41-6 on the road, still the worst loss for Ohio State in its history at home. I believe is still the case. And so you don't want to minimize that. Michigan was down before Bo Schembechler, Purdue beat Michigan, but think about that. Purdue beat Michigan. Was it five straight years, but four in a row in the Big House. I mean, I understand, and Michigan was ranked in the top five under Pete Elliott, Peter Bump Elliott, I should know that, during that time. But a point is, Jack Mollenkopf, Purdue was recruiting, and Purdue went in and got and had the advantage of getting African-American players out of the South before, you know, hard to imagine that you couldn't play college football if you're an African-American in the ACC for the most part and in the SEC. And the Big Ten kind of just got that going, and that's how a Leroy Keyes gets here. That's how a Billy McCoy and a John Bullock and all those guys and many others prior to my time of watching that were terrific football players got to Purdue because of that. And Jack, I think, brought them into a great assimilated them into a tough environment. You'll hear Leroy Keyes talking about, you know, it was not easy to be an African-American at Purdue, even though, you know, just the time that it was. So I would give the nod to Mollenkopf, but we'll talk about Tiller down the road. But Tiller, in a unique way, was his accomplishment was maybe even more astounding. But I think Mollenkopf's teams were better.
And think, too, of the number of bowl games, Alan, Mollenkopf would have gone to. The Big Ten didn't have that archaic rule for years were only the conference champion to go to a bowl game too. So Purdue missed out on a chance to go to so many postseason games during Mollenkopf's tenure. I've always sort of opined and bemoaned that fact when looking at the bowl history of the Southeastern Conference teams and whatnot, that the Big Ten had let other squads beside their conference champion go to bowls. Man, the bowl history for Purdue would be even a lot more illustrious.
Right, and you look at, obviously, the bowl games expanded, but Jack Mollenkopf in today's world would have been in a bowl game of his 13 year or 14 years as head coach, 13 out of 14 years probably. He had 1 year that Purdue was 500 in there, but and his first year was a losing season. But, yeah, no question. And some of those teams, you know, the 67 team would probably have been voted to go to the Rose Bowl because they tied with Indiana and Michigan and Minnesota, and Purdue was not eligible to go. Of course, Indiana went because it hadn't ever been. And in 68 team that did finish 8-2 would have been with a guy like Leroy Keyes and Mike Phipps at quarterback, would have been a team that would have probably played like in an Orange Bowl or something like that, because it was a national brand at that time too. So that's an interesting study. So moving on to Bob DeMoss. And Bob DeMoss, 1970 to 72, and Bob was the head coach, longtime quarterback coach from was an assistant coach really from Purdue 1950 to 1969, probably one of the most celebrated assistant coaches in Purdue history. Gets the job in 70 when Mollenkopf retires. Did not have the success, had some talent certainly, and did not have success in 70 and 71 in terms of winning games. 72, Purdue finishes 6-5. Demo is one of the nicest men in the history of men. He just was a great guy. Maybe too nice, I don't know. But Demo had some great stories about his coaching days. If you can think about this, how college football has changed. Demo used to play golf on Friday afternoons at home football games. You know, they'd have like a press gathering and all that kind of stuff. The world has changed in football coaching. Demo was one of the great offensive minds. His teams did not, especially the 72 team that did not, 6-5 with what, 9 guys drafted in the first 3 rounds or first 4 rounds and 3 first round picks, underachieved. That was disappointing to him, but he moved on. And I don't, people say, well, was Demo fired after 72? I don't know. My gut feeling is that it was a mutual agreement. Demo worked in the athletic department for another 20 years as an assistant athletic director. And I had the chance to work with him during my tenure there, but I think it was a mutual deal. I think Demo was a family man and realized the head coaching job and the stress wasn't for him. And they moved on to Alex Agassi. But your recollections, your stories. I've got a couple other good Demo stories, but that I'll share after I let you chat.
Yeah, Alan, when I was a student in the mid-80s, of course, Bob DeMoss was still working in the athletic department, as you alluded to, when George King was the athletic director, still Buford Byers.
Yeah.
Remember Faye Flood?
Yeah. Faye's still there, I think. Still working there.
Really?
I believe so. Yeah.
Jim Brudzik, of course, and many others. But yeah, like you, I've always sort of wondered 1972. Purdue has 3 first round draft choices on that team, and 5 guys picked in the first 2 or 3 rounds. A team loaded with talent. Jack Mollenkopf recruited off those great teams in the late 1960s. Darryl Stingley, Dave Butts, Otis Armstrong, Greg Bingham, on and on I can go. But, yeah, it's too bad that he couldn't have maybe made more of it. I don't know all the circumstances, Alan. I guess a question for you would be, did Purdue consider anybody else when Jack Mollenkopf stepped down, or was it a fait accompli, as they say, that job is going to be Bob DeMoss's?
Yeah, I think so. In those times, Demo had a chance to go to the Miami Dolphins. I know that, and didn't take the job
as an assistant.
Yes, and around that time, I don't know the exact time frame, but it was 68 or 69.
Did you ever interview for a Big Ten head coaching job or any head coaching jobs?
Not to my knowledge, and again, it's funny. And Demo was a great family man. He's got 3 kids, and they're all extremely successful. He lived, if you just go look at the house that Demo lived in on Knox Drive versus, and I'm not being critical of Jeff Brohm or Matt Painter. I'm just saying that's how college football has changed. If you look at the house that Demo lived in for years, and the houses that Jeff Brohm and Matt Painter live in now, it's just how college football has changed. You know, Demo had issues too. He had a defensive guy, Tony Mason, who I think, as the story goes, there was a lot of conflict between Tony and the defensive staff, and maybe usurping some authority. And Tony wanted the head coaching job. He ended up coaching in Arizona after leaving Purdue. Tony Mason did, and there was some controversy there. You know, Demo is the only thing I would never understand and never understood completely. You know, the wishbone was the thing of the time at those times, and Purdue tried to install it. I remember him having Chuck Fairbanks from Oklahoma come out, and they went out and, or I don't know if Demo went there or they went there, and they tried to install the wishbone offense with Daryl Stingley and Otis Armstrong. I get that to some extent, but you know, Demo was so far ahead of his time as a passing quarterback or coach, you know, with having coached the Ron DiGravios and the Bob Greasys and the Len Dawsons and the Mike Phipps. But, you know, you can sit there and say that, well, why in the heck would you install the wishbone at the start of the 72 season, which he abandoned after week three, I believe. But who knows? But that was something that just didn't work out. And there was some strife there, as I understand. And there always is when things don't go to plan. You know, Demo, again, is one of those guys that was one of the nicest people in the world and very, very skilled offensive mind. Sometimes it doesn't work out the way you plan for the head coaching. But Demo also, whether that Alex Agassi becomes available, Alex Agassi had success at Northwestern, especially in 1970 and 71. With Mike Adamley and Maury Daniu at quarterback, very good teams, very competitive at the upper level of the Big Ten in those years. The 70 team beat Demo and Purdue badly. Purdue went and beat Northwestern on the road in 71. But my point is, Alex Agassi, who had spent time at Purdue during the war, was an All-American at Purdue, gets the job. And whether that – I don't know whether George King, who was the athletic director at the time, I'm sure some of the listeners will pipe in after the fact and say, well, I know that they had Alex Agassi on the pipeline and that had something to do with why Demo gave it up at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that. Alex Agassi seemed like a good match at the time. He had been very well respected and had some success, certainly at Northwestern as the head man. And was a great All-American offensive lineman at Purdue, and maybe defensive lineman that kind of played both ways at Purdue and Illinois at the time. So your memories of Alex, and I have some other things as well.
Yeah, probably the first head coach I have real strong recollections of, Alan. You know, being a fourth, fifth, sixth grader right in there, mid-70s, the 1976 game against Michigan, of course, probably was – Alex Agassi's pinnacle when they knocked off the number one team in America, costing the Wolverines, I guess, the national title that year as well. A tough coach. And Alan, you talked about the resume of Alex Agassi, pretty much unmatched by a lot of people, especially as a player. And cutting his teeth at Northwestern for, looks like, by my account, 9 seasons. Did have pretty good success there up there in Evanston. And again, it just never got going for Agassi and West Lafayette, though. Never had one winning season in 4 short seasons in West Lafayette. I don't know, Alan, was Agassi a guy who was more of a recruiter than a coach, or was he more of a coach than a recruiter? I get the impression that Purdue still had talent back then, but it certainly didn't translate into a lot of success on the field. But this is interesting to note, Alan. Agassi's Big Ten record was 15-17. He went 4-4 in the conference 3 times, 3-5 once. So the guy fared pretty well within the conference.
Yeah, I think Agassi's an interesting guy. He was a man's, you know, as they were. He was the prototypical football coach. I can remember him smoking a cigar and standing on the sideline watching practice with him. I didn't know him well, not that, you know, I knew Demo much better because he was in my neighborhood. So I knew his kids and his daughter, Jane. And then we used to play. One of my best friends lived two doors down from him. So we knew Demo a long time. On Knox Drive in West Lafayette, there was Bob King and there was Bob DeMoss. I mean, within a few feet of each other, just a different time. Alex Agassi came to Purdue. I have a fundamental theory about Purdue football coaches, which I guess you really can prove is true. If you can't throw it, and if throwing isn't a big part of what you do, you're not going to win. And that Purdue has yet to have a coach that really loved to run the football, win consistently. I understand if you look at the numbers that Mollenkopf ran it a lot more than he passed it, but Purdue was still ahead of its time in passing under Mollenkopf with the quarterbacks that we talked about. I didn't throw in Bernie Allen in there, but with DeMoss, Bernie Allen, also Len Dawson, and DeGravio, Greasy, and Phipps. But so Agassi liked to run the ball. I think he did recruit in the Chicago area relatively well. Some guys that he did recruit that turned into really good players, Keena Turner certainly being one, Scott Durking, and I believe that Demo, I believe that Durking was solely recruited by Alex Agassi. Purdue had at that time, and this is not all that different. History doesn't change all that much. Purdue had a lot of guys that wanted to go to Notre Dame or wanted to go to Michigan, Catholic League guys out of Chicago. Purdue would get a lot of the best of the rest there. And I know some people, I don't want to hear that, but that's kind of the way it was. And Alex didn't do a bad job of that. Purdue's offenses were very lackluster in his tenure, did not have great passing quarterbacking. His last year, we've talked about this statistic, zero touchdown passes in 1976. That's hard to believe. Purdue tried to run the ball a lot. And yet Alex Agassi, two of Purdue's greatest upsets in its history came under Alex's watch, 1974 at Notre Dame and then the 76 game at home against Michigan. So he was capable of getting his team, and the players loved Alex, at least the ones you talked to had a great affinity for him. What was amazing is that you beat Michigan in 76, 3 weeks before the end of the year, I think it was, you lose to Indiana and you lose your job. Coaches, and I think George King liked Alex Agassi. He's a hard guy not to like, just didn't have enough success.
Yeah, Mark Vitale, 1976, Allen, zero touchdown passes, 16 interceptions.
Right.
It's unfortunate, like you said, because Agassi was a guy who had a heck of a resume and just couldn't get it done there for the Boilermakers. But you know what? The guy right after Alex Agassi, as you well know, Jim Young, did awfully well. I know you have a lot of great memories of Jim Young. I do too. And you actually stay in touch with Coach Young, who's still doing well deep into his 80s, right?
Right. He is. And I'm so remiss. I will do a more exhaustive, maybe two or three part series on him because he's a fascinating person. One of the, just a guy that has lived his life in 5-year increments, and his 5 years was at Purdue too. That was it as a head coach, right? 77 to 81. Jim Young was he's a Hall of Fame level coach, and there's good reason for it. Purdue was part of that. He was extremely successful at Arizona, got the job at Purdue because of that. And then of course goes on to Army and runs the wishbone at Army he was just resilient. He was a passing guy when he came to Purdue. He was one of those guys that slept in the training room. I don't think Jane, his wife, saw him during football season much. Jim was extremely passionate about doing it, but also ahead of his time from an offensive standpoint. He had some very, very good coaches, which we'll talk about in our assistant coach features. But Jim Young was innovative. And he was smart enough to get a guy named Mark Herman too here but he was good enough to recruit a Dave Young and good enough to have and to get some Alex Agassi guys and move them in position like Joe Tiller did. Keena Turner was a tight end. moves him to the 1502, a rush end, and he's an All-American level, certainly an NFL standout level player. There are several other guys that switched positions. He found ways to make him work, and his team had an extreme toughness to him, and they were fun to watch too, for the most part, because they would throw it a little bit, and especially later in Herman's years, but they also ran it very well. His teams were disciplined, extremely organized football teams that typically didn't beat themselves. Yeah, he couldn't beat Michigan on the road in 78 and 80. That were very disappointing losses for him that kept Purdue from being maybe a Rose Bowl level team. And a tie at Wisconsin in 78 really was devastating. But he took a program that was, you know, again, that was putting in, part of the reason why Alex Agassi gets let go is because nobody was coming to games. You know, crowds were down back in the 50s, thousands at that time. Jim Young brought fans back, and all of a sudden the biggest crowds in the history of Ross-Ade Stadium, 71,000 people, I believe it was in the 81 Notre Dame game or the 81 IU game. I can't remember, but think about that. And Jim Young brought that by doing that. He was, and you've done the what if of what happened if Jim Young would have stayed. Who knows, but Jim Young was a Hall of Fame level coach, and he did not disparage his resume and his time at Purdue.
So tough, Alan. You talked about Jim Young's toughness. That's what I remember too. Bald fist toughness, as I like to say. And that manifests itself in great defense, Alan. You talked about, we all know about Purdue's illustrious offensive history with quarterbacks and throwing the football. But Alan, there aren't too many times in Purdue football history that you can talk about the program having consistently great defense. Well, this certainly was an era where that was true, and that junk defense that everybody knows about was as much a part of that success that Young had 78 to 80 with three bowls in a row, Alan. And talked about Keenan Turner, Calvin Clark, Bill Kay, Kevin Motz, Marcus Jackson, Marcus McKinney. You can go on and on. Wayne Smith. It's a
Ken Lauschen.
Ken Lauschen. He's one of all-time favorites too.
Yeah.
Incredible Hulk, right? They talked about Kingsbury too. I talked to Calvin Clark a couple weeks ago. He said, I think it was Matt Kingsbury.
Tom Kingsbury.
Matt played later, but Tom was Ryan Grigson. But
yeah.
He said Kingsbury was an animal. Undersized, but a total animal. But Alan, 78 to 1980, Purdue lost three Big Ten games total. Three Big Ten games total. Think about that. That's a month usually for Purdue.
Yeah.
I mean, it shows you the level of excellence Jim Young attained in an era, Alan, where there were still unlimited scholarships for programs like Michigan, Ohio State could hoard talent. It's much harder, even a more unlevel playing field back then, much harder to try to knock heads with those elite programs for places like Purdue. But Jim Young did just that. I just wish and lament, as you well know, that he would have stayed. I did that what if, but my goodness, it's kind of just drives you crazy to think if Jim Young would have stuck it out. You know, because Alan, after he left, that's when Purdue really hit its dark ages, got lost in the forest for years. I mean, you had the 1984 Peach Bowl, Alan. Then you had nothing until Joe Tiller got here in 1997.
Well, and I think with Jim Young, the thing that impressed me, and again, I do have a little bit of, I'm good friends with a couple of his players, Bart Burrell and certainly Pete Quinn and Keenan Turner from time to time I talk to, and these guys have such respect for him. And the quality of guys that he had playing for him, there's a correlation, you know, the Dale Schwans, the Tim Holes, and the Kingsburys. We need to do a great story because it's a great story on Tom Kingsbury and the 1980 Purdue, Indiana. He gets hurt in the first play of that game, blows his knee out. But
there's a picture. Yeah, I saw Pete Quinn sent a picture.
Yeah, I love that picture. I never had seen that. I don't know who's picture. Probably a Journal and Courier picture, yeah. But a great photo. But here's my point about Jim Young that I think made him different. He was willing to delegate Leon Burnett and company ran that defense. Not that Jim Young didn't look over it, but he let his guys do his job. And I think that one of the great stories, which has been told before, but 1980, Mark Herman against, I believe it is against Miami of Ohio, or the Minnesota game, I can't remember, but he throws a couple interceptions in the first half, and Young's about to pull him. You know, Scott Campbell, who had started the first game of the 80 season because of Herman's thumb injury, you know, he's about to pull him from the game. And he goes and tells him, if you don't do it next set of downs, you're out. And he also tells him and empowers him to start calling the plays. Now, I know that's unheard of in today's world. Mark Herman, a very cerebral guy, very calm guy, starts calling his own game. And the rest is history, because Mark had one of the best runs of any quarterback in NCAA history from that point forward in the 1980 season. Yes, he finished fourth in Heisman Trophy balloting. But my point is, Jim Young knew how to – he knew he was very, very intellectually capable, one of the smartest people you'll ever know, but a guy that knew how to push the right buttons and led by example and let his guys do the work and wasn't so bullheaded that he had to do it. So I'm very impressed by him, and we'll have more on him. And again, at 85 years old, he has still taught himself to play piano. He's taught himself to golf. He's taught himself Spanish. He's done all these things as a person that has bettered himself, and all kind of in 5-year increments, which was the time that he stayed at Purdue. So Jim Young, an all-timer. Leon Burnett, who was on Jim Young's staff, and the story there is at the start of the 81 season, Jim Young had basically hinted, if not told George King the first week of the season, I'm done after this year. And I think George may have tried to talk him out of it. Jim Young has written about that from his perspective. But Jim, obviously, there were some personal reasons. He'd had some family issues. He'd had burnout. He really thought after Jim Young went at it so hard that after the 1980 season, he wasn't sure he wanted to coach anymore. And he actually stayed at Purdue, as people may remember, for 1982 as an assistant athletic director before getting the job in Army. But in Army was a good fit for him because he was a big military guy, military history guy. It was a good fit. But Leon Burnett was hired, and I don't know that at the time that people lament, Leon had built the junk defense, and Purdue's junk defense was pretty darn good. And Leon was a great personality, bigger than life personality, as you know. I think in today's world of social media, he wouldn't have lived to survive because he would get out and around from now and again, as I recall, as any young person would do. But Leon was an extremely talented defensive coach and a very good recruiter. I mean, one of the best recruiting classes in recent memory is when you get Rod Woodson and you get Ray Wallace, and you got a lot of very, very good players. Jim Everett was actually recruited by Jim Young, but you've got some guys in there that you brought to the table. He just couldn't get the job done from an organization standpoint, I guess. I really have a hard time speaking to that because I didn't play for him. I think the players liked him. I just think that it just didn't work. And any time a coach follows a kind of a legend and doesn't get off to a good start in 82 and 83, Leon wins just 3 games each year. And the air got out of the balloon in the hurry, even though he came back in 84 and with Jim Everett and had a very good season. And with the only team in Purdue history, right, at the time to beat Notre Dame, Michigan, and Ohio State in the same year. So, and again, a loss at Wisconsin late in the year, Purdue could have made its way to Pasadena with the right combination. So, you got to give Leon credit for that. He wasn't a long-term match. He also recruited Jeff George, I should say, the number one player in the country from Warren Central. I'm still getting grief for putting him on my quarterback team from some people, but Jeff George, that is. But so anyway, that's my memories of Leon. A guy that maybe, again, a little bit like Demo, and this is easy to categorize this 40 years later, you shouldn't have hired the assistant. That's true. There may have been some commonality there. But like Leon was a great guy to be around. And my little time around him was that way.
Hire certainly made sense at the time. Why not hand off to the defensive coordinator from who built those great junk defenses, right? And of course, you alluded to Leon's recruiting acumen. You got to get the players, Alan. I don't care how fancy your playbook is, how many pages your playbook has. If you don't have players, none of it matters. And Leon certainly got players. You talked about the class of 83 with Woodson and Chris Dishman, Tony Visco, and Doug Downing. These were recruits any Purdue coach would scream to have, and Leon got them. And on it went to the culmination of getting the number one player, the number one high school player in America, to come to Purdue University, Jeff Jordan. Say what you will about Georgia's personality, but the guy was a mega talent. But man, if he would have stuck it out at Purdue, who knows? Again, it's sort of fascinating to think about. But, yeah, Leon was, I guess, unrefined, Alan.
Yeah.
Maybe he had some Ed Orgeron in him, the LSU head coach.
Oh, no doubt.
A very approachable guy, a guy who could work a room, just a great conversationalist. That's why he was a great recruiter. You know, you were fast friends with Leon Burnett. You can make a connection with him. Very much a player's coach. But again, you know, his staff was pretty good too, Alan.
Yeah.
You had Jim Coletto as an offensive coordinator, and a guy named Joe Tiller as his defensive coordinator, among other good assistants too. So, you know, he had some brain power working alongside him as well. But like you said, the 7-5 season in 1984 was magical. A lot of fun, great memories for me. But again, he just couldn't build on that. 1986, Alan, he resigned, I think, with 3 games to go in the year. And he was out the door just like that. Goes to work for the Indianapolis Colts and Ron Meyer. That's another story for another day. But again, Leon Burnett, what if, what could have been, just never materialized.
Well, and you go back to 86, you know, the players would play for him, and the famous gold jersey game 2 weeks after. And Leon was fired. I mean, he resigned, but that was a bad deal. That wasn't the wrong choice. I'm not saying that. It just was tough because Jeff George felt like, he'd been betrayed. And then, of course, Rod Woodson was not happy after that game and made it known. As I recall, even though Woodson's eligibility was up in the 86 season. But 2 weeks later, you know, they bring out the gold jerseys and beat Indiana, a good Indiana team, a bowl-bound Indiana team, Bill Mallory's first bowl team at IU. And Rod Woodson's Superman game, they got up for him. It helped to have a guy like Rod Woodson, I'll give you that, to have that, and a block kick by Scott Schulte at the end of that game, by Pete Stojanovic had a 30, chip shot field goal for an NFL caliber kicker. And it just didn't work out. I don't want to be revisionist history here, because it was the feeling at the time that Leon really, had he not fixed 84, I think might have been out there. I think there was a lot of feeling at the time that and they did. They pulled up, they come out and beat Notre Dame and they just opened that game, in a game I think you went to at the dedication game of the Hoosier Dome. Again, beat Ohio State, beat Michigan. The Michigan wasn't as good that year, certainly, but you win those games and get to the bowl game and against Virginia and the Magic Man, and they lose that game to Virginia and Don Majkowski. But that is it's just an interesting storyline of what could have been. And Leon was, Leon is kind of a rough person, not a rough person, but he was a country talker. Bear Bryant was famous. They didn't care how Bear Bryant talked either. Some fans didn't like that with Leon because Leon didn't win enough, and that was what it was.
Alan, in 1985, really, Leon couldn't build off that 84 season. Right. So much talent was coming back. There was a lot of energy and excitement. And I was a student. You were working in the athletic department.
Yep.
I mean, Jim Everett was a fifth-year senior. You had Ray Wallace and Rodney Carter and Rod Woodson, Chris Dishman, Steve Griffin. And then the season starts off with that 31-30 loss at Pitt. And then they had their excruciating home loss to Iowa in November, where the clock was probably not operated correctly or stopped in time. you can debate that for eternity.
And that was, yeah.
So close, so many what ifs in 1985. There was certainly enough talent there to go to a bowl game. Who knows, Alan? They go 6-5. Leon gets to a bowl. Maybe he's got a couple more years. But again,
I think he would have. Crowds weren't great, but they were good. But they were good. And watching Jim Everett, etc. But 85, yeah, you lose that. The short arm pass from Jim Everett to Jack Berry for the 2-point conversion at Pitt. As good as Jim Everett was, he'd like to have that throwback. And then you lose it. Just a tough loss to Iowa, Iowa team that was number one, I believe, at the time, under Chuck Long and Hayden Fry.
Alan, you remember how they destroyed Notre Dame at home that year?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just killed him.
Steve Berry, quarterback, just manhandled Notre Dame.
And so this was a team that was well capable, and it just didn't work out. And yeah, another tough loss to Michigan State, and
at home too.
Yeah, when what's his first name? Lorenzo White runs the ball for what, 40 times instead of Ohio State Stadium record. Purdue just couldn't stop him in a 4-point loss. And all those games were just tough losses. And then 86, they just weren't good enough. Mm-hmm. Jeff George, too much on his plate, and they didn't have enough skill to get around it. So those are the four that we talked about. We appreciate all of you listening to us ramble on. Good memories and interesting memories. We'll start next week with Fred Akers. We may gloss over that one quickly, but who knows? There's always stories, great stories. I have some fun stories about playing basketball with Fred Akers, which we'll talk about if I remember, and Jim Coletto as well. Then on to Joe Tiller, Danny Hope, Daryl Hazel, and Jeff Brohm. We'll talk about all of those guys in the history of Purdue coaches over the last 50 years. So, Tom, any parting shots? Anything else you want to add?
No, it's just great working with you, Alan. You know how much I enjoy our walks down memory lane.
Yeah, I hope somebody else does, but we get a lot of people listen to this, so
most of our life is behind us, so we like looking back.
Yeah, that's
what the great thing about the past is, Alan? It can't change.
No, our perceptions of it sometimes do, but that's exactly right. All right, we want to thank our sponsor, and that's the Purdue Union Club Hotel, 811 Restaurant. Highly recommend it when you're on campus. They are on campus, and I was on campus yesterday, masked up and ready to go. We hope that this goes well. But the Union Club is been doing a great job and during serving folks in a safe manner during the pandemic. And they have a great coffee shop as you go in, a great bar as you go back in the back as well, the Boiler Up Bar. So make sure the next time you're on campus that you have a chance to visit that. So, all right, Tom, we'll look forward to doing that next week. Have a great week and happy Saturday or whenever you're listening to this, to all of you. Thanks for listening and watching.